The Lion of Mars dies an ignoble death, fired upon from all sides by loyalist and rebel alike. Watching Luna crackle with nuclear explosions did more to kill the bloodlust between the two navies than any peace or truce ever did. Few men truly like seeing beauty burn. But burn it does. Before the Lion is put to rest, more than 12 bombs detonate, carving new cities of fire and ash among those of steel and concrete. The moon is in turmoil, as is the Gold Armada. With news of the Sovereign's death and the detonation of the bombs, the society shudders beneath our feet. Wealthy praetors are taking their personal ships and fracturing away, heading home to Venus, Mercury, or Mars. They do not stand together, because they do not know where to stand. For 60 years, Octavia has ruled. For most living, she is the only sovereign they have ever known. Our civilization teeters on the brink. Electrical grids are down across the moon. Riots and panic spread as we prepare to leave the sovereign's sanctum. There is an escape ship, but there is no escaping what we've done. We've carved the heart out of the society. If we leave, what takes its place? We knew we could never win Luna by force of arms, but that was never the goal. Just as it was not Ragnar's desire to fight until all golds perished, he knew Mustang was the key. She always has been. That's why he risked our lives to let Kavox go. Now, Mustang stands beneath the hollow of the wounded moon, hearing the silent screams of the city as keenly as I. I step close to her.
Are you ready?
What?
She shakes her head.
How could he do this?
I don't know. But we can fix it.
How? This moon will be pandemonium. Tens of millions dead. The devastation is like...
And we can rebuild it together.
The words flood her with hope. As if she's only just remembered where we are. What we've done. That we're together. Alive. She blinks quickly and smiles at me. Then she looks at my arm, where my right hand used to be, and touches my stomach where Aja stabbed me.
How are you still standing?
Because we're not yet done.
Battered and bloody, we join Cassius, Lysander, and Severo before the door leading out of the Sovereign's inner sanctum. As Cassius types in the Olympic code to open the doors, he pauses to sniff the air.
Ugh. What's that smell?
Smells like a sewer.
Severo stares intensely at the razors he's taken from Aja, including the one belonging to Lorne.
I think it smells like victory.
Did you shit your pants? You did.
Severo.
What? It's an involuntary muscle reaction when you're fake executed and swallow massive amounts of Hamanthus oil. You think I would do that on purpose?
Cassius and I look at each other. I shrug.
Well, maybe.
Yes, actually.
Yeah.
He flips us the crux and makes a face, twisting his lips till it looks like he's going to explode.
What's happening? Are you still...
No.
He throws his water bottle at me.
You stuck a needle full of adrenaline into my chest, asshole. I'm having a heart attack.
He swats our hands as we try to help him.
I'm good.
He wheezes for a moment, before straightening with a grimace.
Are you sure you're prime?
Left arm's numb. Probably need a yellow.
We snort, laughs. We look like walking corpses. Only thing keeping me up are the stim packs we found on the Praetorians. Cassius hobbles like an old man, but he's kept Lysander close to him, vetoing Severo's offers to end the loon bloodline here and now by drawing his razor. Cassius declared that the boy was under his protection. Lysander walks with us now as a sign of our legitimacy.
I love you all.
I adjust the unconscious jackal, who I carry on my shoulder as a prize.
No matter what happens,
Even Cassius?
Hey, especially me, today.
Stay close.
Mustang clutches the scepter tight. The first great door parts. Mustang squeezes my hand. Sevro vibrates with fear. Then the second rumbles and dilates open to reveal a hall filled with Praetorians, their weapons drawn and pointed into the mouth of the bunker. Mustang steps forward, bearing two symbols of power, one in each hand.
Praetorians, you serve the Sovereign. The Sovereign is dead. A new star rises.
She continues walking toward them, refusing to break her step when she nears their line of bristling metal. I think a young Gold with furious eyes might pull the trigger, but his old captain puts a hand on the man's weapon, lowering it. And they break for her, parting and lowering their weapons one by one. They back away to let her pass, their helmets slithering back into their armor. I've never seen a woman so glorious and powerful as she is now. She is the calm eye of the storm, and we follow in her wake. Riding the Dragon Maw lift up in silence, more than four dozen of the Praetorians have come with us. We find the Citadel in chaos. Servants ransacking rooms, guards leaving their posts in two and threes, worried for their families or their friends. The Obsidians we said were coming are still in orbit. Zephy is with the ships. We only created the ruse to draw men from the room. But it seems word has spread. The Sovereign is dead. The Obsidians are coming. Amidst the chaos, there is only one leader. And as we move through the Citadel's black marbled halls, past towering gold statues and departments of state, soldiers gather behind us, their boots stampeding over the marble halls to flock to Mustang, the one symbol of purpose and power left in the building. She lifts both her symbols of power high in the air, and those who first raise weapons against us see them, and me and Cassius and the swelling mass of soldiers behind us, and realize they're fighting the tide. They join us, or they run. Some take shots at us, or rush forward in small bands to halt our progress, but they're cut down before they get within 10 meters of Mustang. By the time we come before the great ivory-white doors to the Senate chambers, behind which senators have been sequestered inside by Praetorians, an army of hundreds is at our backs, and only a thin line of Praetorians bars our way to the Senate chamber, 20 in number. An elegant gold knight steps forward, leader of the men guarding the chamber. He eyes the hundred behind us, seeing the purple adherents Mustang has gathered, the Obsidians, the Greys, me. And he makes a decision. He salutes Mustang sharply.
My brother has 30 men in the Citadel, the Bone Riders. Find them and arrest them, Captain. If they resist, kill them.
Yes, Lady Augustus.
He snaps his fingers and departs with a fist of soldiers. The two Obsidians guarding the doors push them open for us, and Mustang strides into the Senate chamber. The room is vast, a tiered funnel of white marble. At the bottom center is a podium, from which the Sovereign presides over the 10 levels of the chamber. We enter on the north side, causing a disruption. Hundreds of beady politico eyes turn their entitled focus toward us. They will have watched the broadcast, seen Octavia die, seen the bombs wrecking their moon. And somewhere in the room, Roke's mother will stand up from her seat on her marble bench and crane her neck to watch our bloody band stomping down the white marble stairs to the bottom center of the great chamber, passing senators to our right and left, bringing silence with us instead of shouts or protests. Lysander trails behind Cassius. You can hear the rasping, panicked breath of the Senate Majority Speaker as his pink attendants help his withered form down from the podium where he was presiding over something of great importance. They were holding an election. Here, now, in the middle of chaos. And now they look like children who've been caught with their hands in the biscuit jar. Of course, they would never suspect that the Praetorians guarding them would support rebels, or that we could walk from the Sovereign's bunker unimpeded. But they've created a society of fear, where men and women must attach themselves to a rising star to survive. That's all this is. That simple human directive that allows for this coup to work. The old power is dead. See how they flock to the new. Mustang takes the podium with the rest of us flanking her. I toss the jackal to the ground so the Senate can see what has become of him. He's unconscious and pale from blood loss. Mustang looks at me. This is a moment she never wanted. But she accepts it as her burden, just as I have accepted mine as Reaper. I see how it troubles her, how she will need me as I've needed her. But I could never stand where she stands, or hold what she holds. Not without destroying everyone in this room. They would never accept it. If I am the bridge to the low colors, she's the bridge to the high. Only together can we bind these people. Only together can we bring peace.
Senators of the Society, I stand before you, Virginia Au Augustus, daughter of Nero Au Augustus of the Lion House of Mars. You may know me. 60 years ago, Octavia Au Lune stood before you with the head of a tyrant, her father, and laid her claim on the post of sovereign to this society.
Her keen eyes scour the room.
I stand before you now with the head of a tyrant.
She lifts her left hand to show the head of Octavia, one of the two objects which granted us passage here. Gold respects only one thing, and to change, they must be tamed by that one thing.
The old age has brought nuclear holocaust to the heart of the society. Millions burned for Octavia's greed. Millions burn now for my brothers. We must save ourselves from ourselves before the inheritance of humanity is ash. Today, I declare the beginning of a new age.
She looks at me.
With new allies, new ways. I have the rising at my back. A navy made of great golden houses, which holds the obsidian horde in orbit. You have a choice before you.
She tosses the head on the stone podium and raises her other hand. In it is the Dawn Scepter, bestowing upon the bearer the right to rule society.
Bend or break.
A silence fills the chamber. So vast, I feel it might swallow us all into itself and begin the war anew. No gold will be the first to bend. I could make them. But better I bend for them. I fall to my knee before Mustang. Looking up into her eyes, I put my stump over my heart and feel myself swept away by the impossible joy of the moment.
Hail, Sovereign!
Then Cassius falls to his knee, and several. Then Lysander Auloon and the Praetorians. And then, one by one, the senators fall to their knees, till all but 50 kneel, and break the silence together, shouting with a single, riotous voice. A week after Mustang's ascension, I stand beside her to watch her brother hang. But for Valiai Wrath and some 10 men, the Jackal's Bone Riders have been found and executed. Now their leader walks past me through the crowded Luna Square. His hair is feathery and combed, his prisoner jumpsuit lime green. The low colors around us watch in silence. A light dusting of snow falls from a thin skin of grey clouds. I'm nauseous from my radiation medication, but I came for her as she came for me to watch Roke buried. She's quiet and serene beside me, face pale as the marble beneath our feet. The Talmanises stand beside her, watching impassively as the jackal climbs the stairs of the metal scaffold to where the white hangwoman waits.
For the crimes of treason.
The woman reads the sentence.
Mass murder.
Jeers are shouted from the crowd. A bottle shatters at the jackal's feet. A stone splits his forehead.
The sentence is death.
But he does not blink or buckle. He stands proud and vain as they loop the noose around his neck. I wish this would bring Pax back to us, that Quinn and Roke and Io could live again. But this man has carved his mark in the world. The Jackal of Mars will never be forgotten. The white moves for the lever, snow gathering on Adrius's hair. Mustang swallows, and the trapdoor opens. On Mars, there's not much gravity, so you have to pull the feet to break the neck. They let the loved ones do it. On Luna, there's even less.
To any wishing to aid the condemned.
But no one comes forward from the crowd as the white extends the invitation. Not a soul lifts a finger as the jackal's legs kick and his face purples. There's a stillness in me watching the sight, as if I'm a million kilometers away. I cannot feel for him. Not now. Not after all he's done. But I know Mustang does. I know this tears her apart. So I lightly squeeze her hand and guide her forward. She moves across the snow in a daze to grip her twin brother's feet. Looking up at him, as if this were a dream, she whispers something and, lowering her head, she pulls down, showing him he was loved, even at the end. In the weeks following the bombing of Luna and the ascension of Mustang, the world has changed. Millions lost their lives, but for the first time, there is hope. In the aftermath of her speech to the Senate, dozens of gold ships defected, joining the forces of Orion and Victra. The Ash Lord did his best to rally his navy, but with Luna burning, his fleet fracturing, and Mustang as sovereign, it was all he could do to keep his own ships from falling into enemy hands. He retreated to Mercury with the core of his forces. In his absence, Mustang has secured the cooperation of much of the military, particularly the Grey Legions and Obsidian Slave Knights. She has used this political muscle to take the first steps to dismantling the Color Hierarchy and the Gold Grip on military power. The Senate has been disbanded. The Board of Quality Control has been dissolved. Thousands face charges of crimes against humanity. Justice will not be so quick as it was with the Jackal, or so clean. But we will do the best we can. I thought I might be able to rest after Octavia was dead, but we are not without enemies. Romulus and the Moon Lords remain on the rim. The Ash Lord aims to rally Mercury and Venus. Gold warlords have begun carving out claims, and Luna itself is a disaster. Overrun by riots and shortages of food and spreading radiation. She will survive, but I doubt she will ever look the same. No matter how much Quicksilver promises to rebuild the city to even greater heights. My own body is in recovery. Mickey and Virini reattached my hand, which I retrieved from the Jackal shuttle that set down on Luna. It will be months before I can write again, much less use a blade, though I hope I have less cause for that in the coming days. In my youth, I thought I would destroy the society, dismantle its customs, shatter the chains, and something new and beautiful would simply grow from the ashes. That's not how the world works. This compromised victory is the best mankind could hope for. Change will come, slower than Dancer or the Sons want, but it will come without the price of anarchy. So we hope. Under the supervision of Holiday, Seffi is set off to Mars to begin the slow process of freeing the rest of her people, visiting the poles with medicine instead of weapons. I remember how dark her eyes seemed when she looked at one of the Jackal's nuclear craters in person. For now, she's embraced the legacy of her brother and plans to settle on warmer land set aside for her people on Mars. Though she wishes to keep her people from the alien cities, I think she knows, deep down, that she will not be able to control them. The Obsidians will leave their prisons. They will grow curious, spread, and assimilate. Their world will never be the same. Nor will that of my people. Soon, I will return to Mars to help Dancer lead the migration of Reds to the surface. Many will stay and continue the lives they know. But for others, there will be a chance for life under the sky. I said farewell to Cassius the day before last as he departed Luna. Mustang wanted him to stay and help us shape a new, fairer system of justice. But he's had enough of politics.
You don't have to go,
I told him, as I stood with him on the landing pad.
Well, there's nothing for me here but memories. I've been living my life too long for others. I want to see what else is out there. You can't fault me for that.
And the boy?
I nod to Lysander, who moved into the ship, carrying a satchel of belongings.
Severo thinks it's a mistake to let him live. What were his words? It's like leaving a pit viper egg under your seat. Sooner or later, it's gonna hatch.
And what do you think?
I think it's a different world, so we should act like it. He's got Lorne's blood in his veins as much as he's got Octavius. Not that blood makes a difference anymore.
My tall friend smiled fondly at me.
He reminds me of Julian. He's a good soul, despite everything. I'll raise him right, away from all of this.
He extended a hand, not to shake mine, but to give me the ring he took from my finger the night Lorne and Fitchner died. I closed his hand back around it.
That belongs to Julian.
He nodded, softly.
Thank you, brother.
And there, on a Citadel landing platform, in what was once the heart of Gold Power, Cassius, Aubalona, and I shake hands and say farewell. Almost 6 years to the day since we first met. Weeks later, I watch the waves lap at the shore as a gull careens overhead. Whitecaps mark the dark water that lashes the northern beach's sea stacks. Mustang and I set our little two-person flyer down on the east-northeast coast of the Pacific Rim, at the edge of a rainforest on a great peninsula. Moss grows on the rocks, on the trees. The air is crisp, just cold enough to see your breath. It is my first time on Earth, but I feel like my spirit has come home.
Io would have loved it here, wouldn't she?
Mustang wears a black coat with the collar pulled up around her neck. Her new Praetorian bodyguards sit in the rocks, a half kilometer off.
Yes, she would have.
A place like this is the beating heart of our songs. Not a warm beach or a tropical paradise. This wild land is full of mystery. It holds its secrets covetously, behind arms of fog and veils of pine needles. Its pleasures, like its secrets, must be earned. It reminds me of my dreams of the Vale. The smoke from the fire we made of driftwood rises diagonally across the horizon.
Do you think it will last?
Mustang watches the water from our place in the sand.
The peace?
It would be the first time.
She grimaces and leans into me, closing her eyes.
At least we have this.
I smile, reminded of Cassius as an eagle skims low over the water, before rising up through the mist and disappearing in the trees that jut from the top of a sea stack.
Have I passed your test?
My test?
Ever since you blocked my ship from leaving Phobos, you've been testing me. I thought I passed on the ice, but it didn't stop there.
You noticed,
she says, with a mischievous little grin. It fades, and she brushes hair from her eyes.
I'm sorry that I couldn't just follow you. I needed to see if you could build. I needed to see if my people could live in your world.
No, I understand that. But there's more to it. Something changed when you saw my mother, my brother. Something opened up in you.
She nods, eyes still on the water.
There's something I have to tell you.
I look over at her.
You lied to me for nearly 6 years, since the moment we met. In the Lycos Tunnel, you broke what we had. That trust, that feeling of closeness we built. Piecing that together takes time. I needed to see if we could find what we lost. I needed to see if I could trust you.
Well, you know you can.
I do. Now. But...
I frown.
Mustang, you're shaking.
Just let me finish. I didn't want to lie to you, but I didn't know how you'd react, what you would do. I needed you to make the choice to be more than a killer, not just for me, but for someone else too.
She looks past me to the blue sky, where a ship coasts lazily down. I hold my hand up against the autumn sun to watch it approach.
Are we expecting company?
Of a sort.
She stands. I join her, and she goes to her tiptoes to kiss me. It is a gentle, long kiss that makes me forget the sand under our boots, the smell of pine and salt in the breeze. Her nose is cold against mine, her cheeks ruddy. All the sadness, all the hurt in the past, making this moment all the sweeter. If pain is the weight of being, love is the purpose.
I want you to know that I love you more than anything.
She backs away from me, pulling me along.
Almost.
The ship skims over the evergreen forest and sets down on the beach. Its wings fold backward like a settling pigeon, sand and salt spray kicked up by its engines. Mustang's fingers twine through mine as we trudge through the sand. The ramp unfurls. Sophocles sprints out onto the beach, running toward a group of seagulls. Behind him comes the voice of Kavax, and the sweet sound of a child laughing. My feet falter. I look over at Mustang in confusion. She pulls me on, a nervous smile on her face. Kavax exits the ship with Dancer. Victra and Severo come with, waving over to me before looking expectantly back up the ramp. I used to think the life strands of my friends frayed around me because mine was too strong. Now I realize that when we are wound together, we make something unbreakable. Something that lasts long after this life ends. My friends have filled the hollow carved in me by my wife's death. They've made me whole again. My mother joins them now on the ramp, walking with Kieran to set foot on Earth for the first time. She smiles like I did when she smells the salt. The wind kicks her grey hair. Her eyes are glassy and full of the joy my father always wanted for her. And in her arms, she carries a laughing child with golden hair.
Mustang? Who is that?
Darrow, that is our son. His name is Pax.
Pax was born 9 months after the lion's reign, as I lay in the jackal's stone table. Fearing that our enemies would seek the boy out if they knew of his existence, Mustang kept her pregnancy a secret on the Deja Thoris until she was able to give birth. Then, leaving the child to be guarded by Kavok's wife in the asteroid belt, she returned to war. That peace she intended to make with the Sovereign was not just for her and her people, but for her son. She wanted a world without war for him. I can't hate her for that, for keeping this secret from me. She was afraid. Not just that she could not trust me, but that I was not prepared to be the father my son deserves. That was her test, all this time. She almost told me in Tinos, but after conferring with my mother, she decided against it. Mother knew if I realized I had a son, I would not be able to do what needed to be done. My people needed a sword, not a father. But now, for the first time in my life, I can be both. This war is not over. The sacrifices we made to take Luna will haunt our new world. I know that. But I am no longer alone in the dark. When I first stepped through the gates of the Institute, I wore the weight of the world on my shoulders. It crushed me, broke me. But my friends have pieced me together. Now they each carry a part of Io's dream. Together, we can make a world fit for my son, for the generations to come. I can be a builder, not just a destroyer. Io and Fitchner saw that when I could not. They believed in me. So whether they wait for me in the Vale or not, I feel them in my heart. I hear their echo beating across the worlds. I see them in my son. And when he is old enough, I will take him on my knee, and his mother and I will tell him of the rage of Ares, the strength of Ragnar, the honor of Cassius, the love of Sevro, the loyalty of Victra, and the dream of Io, the girl who inspired me to live for more.
Morningstar Book 3 of the Red Rising Saga, Part 2 by Pierce Brown, is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 2016 by Pierce Brown. All rights reserved. Recorded by arrangement with Pierce Brown, care of Liza Dawson Associates. Production copyright 2024, Graphic Audio LLC. All rights reserved. Unauthorized download and/or duplication is prohibited. Narrated by Stuart Crank, with performances by Jenna Sharp as Mustang, Kay Alluvian as Roke, John Vertulo as Sevro, John Keelty as Cassius, Julianne Elliott as Octavia Alloon, Karen Novak as Sephi, Jeff Baker as Romulus, Nia DeRusso as Aja, Andrew James Spooner as the Jackal, and Stuart Crank as Darrow. Also with Andy Brownstein, Andy Clements, Bradley Foster Smith, Colleen Delaney, Danny Gavigan, Elena Anderson, Ian Putnam, Ken Jackson, Kimberly Gilbert, Laura C. Harris, Lucy Simons, Marnie Penning, Martin Dickinson, Matthew Bassett, Melody Muse, Michael Glenn, Michael John Casey, Nanette Savard, Peter Stanley, Richard Rowan, Shanta Parasharaman, Stephanie Namet Parker, Todd Schofield, Yasmin Twazon, and Pierce Brown. Directed and adapted for graphic audio by Dave Fernandez. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Dave Fernandez. Produced by Colleen Delaney, Scott McCormick, David Zitney, Casey Green, and Aaron Coe. Executive producers Angie Cornett, Dwayne Beeman, and Matt Webb. If you've enjoyed Morningstar Part 2, you may also enjoy the Gideon Sable series by Simon R. Green, along with our entire catalog of exciting releases at www.graphicaudio.net.
Medea was short and slight, with a face like a silent movie star, all hollows and shadows. She had a spooky, if somewhat faded, glamour, and her eyes were hidden behind industrial-strength sunglasses. Her long gray robe hung about her in unflattering billows. A silk scarf covered her hair, bulging out here and there as the snakes stirred restlessly. Medea sat solidly on her seat, as though she had protected her post for ages without complaint, and was perfectly happy to sit there for ages more. The Gorgon was Honest John's unsleeping watchdog, and no one had got past her in living memory. But then, she'd never met Gideon Sable. She leaned forward a little, as though to get a better look at Annie and me. And for all my confidence in my plan, I still had to fight down an urge to take several steps back. I took off my sunglasses and slipped them into my jacket pocket. I didn't want her thinking I was trying to compete. According to the gossip I'd heard, once Medea had turned unwanted visitors into stone statues, Honest John would then sell them on as lawn ornaments. Unless they happened to be people who had seriously annoyed him, in which case he smashed them into rubble with a sledgehammer. Sometimes he sold tickets.
"Greetings, oh glorious goddess with the wriggling hair. Mad Mental Mickey salutes you, accompanied by the lovely and very well-connected Miss Ophelia Knightley."
"Knock it off. You're Gideon Sable and Annie anybody. Did you really think you could con your way past me?"
"Well, that was the plan. How were you able to see through our disguises?"
Medea indulged herself with a brief but disturbingly sinuous shrug.
"I see what is. The better to turn it into something else. I once had a friend who could turn people into pigs, but stone is more permanent. All you need to know is that I can see everything that exists with complete clarity."
"Good. I was counting on that." Before my last heist, the gypsy seer Madame Osiris had presented me with a crystal eyeball to help me steal the Mask of Ra from a casino in Las Vegas, and I never did get around to giving it back. When I looked through the crystal ball, I could see through all illusions, just like the Gorgon. Medea had to make eye contact with me for her transformation spell to work, and as she lifted her hand to her sunglasses, I produced the crystal ball from my jacket pocket. The Gorgon removed her shades with a dramatic gesture, revealing eye sockets crammed full of crackling energies. It was like staring at a lightning bolt that was heading straight for you.
Thanks for listening to this graphic audio production. Graphic Audio has over 1,700 titles to choose from. Listen to over 225 binge-worthy series. We feature titles in genres like science fiction, fantasy, romanticy, westerns, mystery thrillers, comics, and more. Check out our exclusive series such as Deathlands, Rogue Angel, Outlanders, Tangent Knights, and Agent of Exiles, which are only available in our dramatized adaptation format. Experience a radically different type of audiobook produced with a full cast, sound effects, and cinematic music. Listen to a movie in your mind, on the go, anytime, anywhere. Our dramatized adaptation titles are available at all major audiobook retailers and platforms. Sign up for our email newsletter for the latest updates and new releases. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, and other social media platforms. For more information and samples of all our titles, visit our website at graphicaudio.net.